I hate that we're living lives where we're too busy to sit down and have dinner with our family. We need to shift our whole culture to where we're not so busy, to where things are in service of being able to have the time to connect and nurture physical, mental, and social health, because that's the point of living. If we don't have time to spend time with our loved ones, what are we doing?
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. It wasn't too long ago that mental health was a taboo topic. Diagnoses were swept under the rug, and suicides often were family secrets. And while there's definitely still progress to make, we've come a long way in recognizing, addressing, and talking about mental health. Our guest today is asking, can we do the same for social health? Kasley Killam is the author of The Art and Science of Connection, Why Social Health is the Missing Key to Living Longer, Healthier, and Happier. Her work and research focuses on a vital component of a healthy life, human connection. And the stats are pretty depressing and compelling. Over the last 20 years, time spent with friends dropped from 30 to 10 hours a month. 30%, almost a third of Americans, report being lonely at least once a week. And loneliness is linked to many bad health outcomes, from increased risk of premature death to heart disease, stroke, and depression. Kasley joins us to talk about how we can reverse the loneliness epidemic by choosing connection first and why we need a social health movement today. So please welcome Kasley Killam to The Other 80. Hi, Kasley. It's so wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Claudia. I love talking with you and getting any Claudia time that I can. So this
Oh my gosh. We met, not for the first time, but for the most recent time at Aspen Ideas Health last year. We had a fun little trip through the rain on the golf cart.
We did on a golf cart.
I was just so captivated then and still am now by your work, by your book, and really at how you don't just sketch out this enormous opportunity and problem we have in society around social health, but really lay out a framework for thinking about shifting it at the very personal level, but also at the societal level. And I thought we might start with two aspects of your work that I think are really compelling. First, you just do a beautiful job of pulling together data and evidence for why this is an important issue. So I want to start with that. And then the second I find so captivating is you also experiment a lot at a very personal level as a way to think about how to make interventions. So let's start with the evidence. Why is this an important issue for us to all be thinking about, both in our own particular lives, but also more broadly?
Sure. The reason it's so important to think about this is because right now we have this very real world need where many people around the world feel lonely on a regular basis. So the theme that I've been exploring for almost 15 years now is this notion that our relational lives, the connections that we form, the relationships that we build, and the communities that we are part of influence not just our mood, not just how happy we are in life, but also literally the functioning of our bodies, how healthy we are, our risks for things like heart disease and stroke and dementia and depression, and at the very extreme end, our mortality and actually how long we live. We see and we hear increasingly in recent years about what many people call a loneliness epidemic, where a lot of people around the world are experiencing loneliness on a regular basis. They feel like they don't have people they can confide in. They're not, connected in the ways that are fulfilling to them. And so we know from the research that connection determines how long we live, how healthy we are while we're alive, how happy we are, how we thrive as humans. And yet, we're not seeing that people are really living that, right? It actually feels like the opposite is happening while we're so connected through digital means, and yet we're not connected in the ways that are really nourishing. And so in my work, I've been exploring this idea of elevating relationships through this language of social health and really kind of redefining health as not just physical and mental, like we typically talk about, but also social. And by that, I mean not just social determinants and the kind of environment around us, but actually our relationships and our connections. And so while physical health is about the body and mental health is about the mind, social health is about our relationships. I came at this originally through the lens of public health, exploring loneliness through that lens and thinking, like you mentioned, about what we can do as individuals, but also how do we set up our culture and society in a way that enables people to live more socially healthy lives.
I find it intriguing and also so helpful that you self-describe as an introvert. So you're not this person that is always the one that wants to be in the social environment trying to tell the rest of us to come on in, the party's fun, right? You are someone who's been really prioritizing this in your own life, but also doing it from the perspective of needing to find your own balance and time. And part of the way you approach it is really as an N of one scientist, where you've run experiments on yourself, you've tried different techniques, you've shared some of those in your book. And I thought I'd just ask you to describe a time when you had to take the research and practices that you've been thinking about and really dig down and apply it to yourself.
To your point about introversion, if I was some social butterfly who was just telling everyone to, you know, socialize all the time with everyone and go to parties, that would just be so nauseating to a good portion of humanity, right? Like there's so much nuance to the ways we connect and how much we connect and what's fulfilling to each person. But to your point, I love experimenting. I mean, that's truly where the passion for all this started was, okay, here's what the data says. How do we actually apply this in our own lives? And what does that mean for you and me? So one example was that in the final semester of my undergrad, I did a project where for 108 days, I did an act of kindness every single day. And so this was incorporating research on things like gratitude. You know, when you write a thank you card to someone, it boosts your mood and it deepens your connection and so on. There's data on things like doing random acts of kindness and the way that that helps connect people and so on. So I was taking some of this literature from positive psychology and other areas and really applying it for this concentrated period of time. And it was so interesting because I am an introvert. So doing an act of kindness every day meant, you know, going out every single day with the intention of connecting and not always just with people I knew, with complete strangers. I did all kinds of crazy things. They ranged a lot. They were simple things like writing thank you notes to the janitor in my apartment building or to my mom. They were things like, volunteering at a local retirement community and a local soup kitchen and getting to know people there, or also kind of fun, obnoxious things like handing out helium balloons to people in downtown Toronto to make them smile. And I still have these vivid memories of a little kid walking down with a helium balloon next to this man in a suit who clearly just come from like corporate Toronto, also carrying his own balloon, you know. On one of the days, I did free hugs. I stood outside the campus library with signs that said, if you're feeling stressed about exams, have a free hug. And I hugged hundreds of people for like 2 hours. And it was amazing. I mean, here I was as an introvert going to the campus library thinking, what have I gotten myself into? This is a nightmare. Why am I doing this?
Did you think about ending it halfway through?
Oh, yeah. I was like, if I didn't have a friend with me who I'd recruited to do it with me, I think I would have backed out. And it ended up being one of the most memorable, fun experiences. But what I found was that at the end of this kind of quote unquote experiment, my life was better in just about every way you can imagine. I mean, I was so energized from the high of the connections I was making. I had gotten closer to my friends and my family. I had made new friends. I felt deeply connected to the community that I was living in. But also because I was energized and motivated, despite being an introvert, it meant that I felt motivated to do other things. I was cooking more. I was exercising more. When you make connection a priority, and when you're intentional about seeking out those opportunities because they are all around us, it's transformative. It's transformative for you and it's transformative for the people around you.
I am the person, this is embarrassing. I don't think I've ever admitted this even to my husband. Especially if somebody is someone I may not feel totally at ease with. If I see them in the grocery store, I literally will find a different aisle. Every time it happens, I say to myself, what are you doing? And I think it's just, I'm in my own little space, my task. And one of the examples I love from your work is your to love list instead of your to do list.
It's very relatable. I mean, Claudia, I feel that same impulse. I get it. And I give into it.
Maybe you don't act on it.
Sometimes I do. Absolutely. I'm not by no means, this is partly why I'm so interested in all of this is because it doesn't necessarily come naturally to me either. So yeah, I think it's a very relatable experience. And what I found is that when I do push myself beyond my comfort zone, and what the research shows too, is when people in general push themselves beyond their comfort zone a little bit, there's this zone of kind of magic that can happen. It's worth exploring and experimenting with it.
I wanted to also ask about a recent experience, maybe in the last year, that was really magical from a connection standpoint. And then put on your scientist hat for you personally. Put on your scientist hat and describe why you think that was.
Oh, what a good question. I can think of one event in particular that I did where I gave a talk about the book and people came up to me afterward who I'd never met before and shared their own experiences. And fully opened up to me about things that had happened in their life and the struggles that they have. You know, one person saying they just often feel like they don't even know how to start a conversation with someone, like literally asking me, what questions do I ask to have a meaningful conversation? Or someone else saying, you know, I travel a lot for work and I often feel lonely during that time. And so sometimes I turn to AI for companionship and sharing about that experience, you know, really opening up. And that means so much to me. First of all, you know, writing a book is not easy. And so for it to resonate and for people to get ideas from it, that's just the best possible outcome. But also I think what's putting on my scientist hat, like you said, what are those ingredients there that makes that connection meaningful? One is that there's vulnerability, right? And so there's this idea in the literature about self-disclosure, where when you share something a little vulnerable that goes beyond kind of surface level and small talk, that is like this magical way of deepening connections, right? It builds trust. It builds intimacy. It makes us relatable. It helps us get to know each other better. And so there we are. There I am with a complete stranger who's, you know, I've maybe shared something on stage or in conversation. They're now sharing something really intimate and vulnerable about their life. And that just creates this beautiful moment.
And it says so much about you that they felt that was an invitation and an opening that they could share and that you made a comfortable space for them to do it.
Thank you.
I was so struck at two words you use in the space of social health. One is solitude as being part of social health practices, and the other was awe. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about both of those.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So solitude, I mean, this comes back to the point about being an introvert. You know, there's kind of this baseline amount of interaction that we all need to feel connected, but that amount varies person to person. And part of being socially healthy means having a strong relationship with yourself, having alone time, especially if you're an introvert. Being able to nourish that, because connection with other people comes from connection with yourself. If you have that solid foundation, that's really powerful. And this was something I also had to experiment with. I mean, when I was younger, it was so hard for me to open up even to my closest friends and to be really real about things that I was going through. And that was something that I kind of learned over time to self-disclose more and to get more vulnerable. But I learned that because I first turned the acceptance and love toward myself. I explored this practice of self-compassion where you kind of turn the compassion that you have for other people toward yourself. And through deepening that connection with myself, I was better able to open up to others. For me, you know, I get really nerdy about the fact that kindness and connection in our relationships literally change the functioning of our bodies. And we have stronger immune systems and less inflammation and all these things if we feel supported. That to me is awe-inspiring. It's also awe-inspiring that the data is pretty clear that even just simple gestures of connection can be very meaningful. What comes to mind for you when you hear awe and awe in this context?
Some of the reading and prep I did for this interview made me also think about the concept where people move together or sing together, where they have vibrations together. So I was also thinking about the aspects of social health that are actually quiet, silent meeting, meditation, not talking one-on-one, singing, drumming, dancing. I felt a lot of awe in those moments where there's a sense of belonging in a group that's moving together, which is interesting because we think of it as being the interaction. But I do think that these other meaningful moments of collective purpose, even working together in the garden or something else where there's a deep sense of connection that's not based on talking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. And I think this is something I write about a bit in the book, this idea that being socially healthy, it's partly the one-on-one relationships and interactions that we have, but it's also feeling connected to something bigger, right? Feeling like we're part of groups or communities or connected to all of humanity or connected to life itself. That can help us feel like we're not alone. And that matters as well.
Many of the listeners of the show are in the healthcare field, and you have some really compelling examples of ways in which healthcare and the medical system could be incorporating these practices. Some of the examples might be screening for social health and connection. It might be creating physical spaces that are conducive to gathering or to connecting. It could be promoting patient groups where there's peer support or even prescribing social connection. And I'm wondering if there are particular healthcare organizations that are pioneering these things the most, and what are they doing? What are they trying, and what are they learning?
There is this whole push toward this idea of social prescribing, not just for loneliness and disconnection, but also for other kind of needs. So this idea of social prescribing is where doctors screen for things like loneliness in a visit. And then if someone is at risk, they prescribe things like connection or time in nature or volunteering in the local community or, you know, joining a book club, things like this to get people reengaged. And this is a very common practice in the UK. And a lot of the early data is showing that it really does benefit patient outcomes. So that's very exciting. There's a push in the US as well. The Social Prescribing USA organization is leading a lot of that. And there are many researchers in this space too. So I think it's a really interesting trend that we're going to see more and more of. So in terms of specific organizations, Sachin Jain, who I know you had on your podcast previously, first at CareMore and then at SCAN, implemented the first ever chief togetherness officers, where he actually employed people to lead these efforts around togetherness with their patient base. And this included things like a phone call program where they were reaching out and kind of a buddy matching among older adults who were isolated and a variety of different things that they did. He was really saying, we know so many of our patients are isolated or lonely. We know this is affecting their health outcomes. Let's do something about it, and had really remarkable results. But it was interesting when I interviewed him for the book, he basically said, you know, I asked him about kind of the future of this and where does he see it going from there, expecting him to say this kind of program should be in every single healthcare institution and this should be the norm. No, he basically said, we're addressing this because we have to, but this is a cultural issue. These people shouldn't be isolated or lonely in the first place, and it shouldn't get to the point where healthcare where the healthcare system has to be addressing this. We need a movement where we redesign the fabric of our lives so that people aren't even isolated or lonely by the time they're working with their doctors in the first place. And I think this, his comments really struck me, but they really point to the fact that there's so much we can do as individuals, and we need to set up our culture in a different way. We need to change the social norms. It's weird that most people don't know their neighbors. You know, why is that a social norm here? It's weird that we go to public spaces and shared spaces and don't actually necessarily talk to anyone other than the people we know, or we stay alone. This is so infused into the culture of how we're living at this point. And I think that needs a massive reset. And that's partly there's a role for healthcare. Partly there's a role in technology and urban design and education and in all these different arenas. But it also takes each and every one of us recognizing that something's got to change, and we can each play a role in our own lives, but also in the organizations and sectors that we're part of.
The previous Surgeon General, who I think you might have mentioned, Vivek Murthy, did a great job of laying out the problem and the issues and what our challenge is today. But I think we'll leave it to the future generations and other leaders to say, here's what we're going to do about it. So if you had your 5 minutes with either the president or the new Surgeon General, what would be your recommendation for the agenda or the initiative that really is timely right now?
The first thing that comes to mind is in 2020, coming out of the pandemic, coming out of doing my graduate work focused on this topic, I founded a small nonprofit called Social Health Labs. And the first project that we launched was a monthly microgrant program to give $1,000 to community builders across the country. These were people who weren't doing it for their day jobs. They just had ideas for how to connect people in their local neighborhoods. And I learned a lot from running this program. The first thing I learned is that there are so many people who have ideas for local ways to connect and build community and to improve social health. I mean, we had thousands of applications and we were giving out one grant a month. The other thing I learned is that the ripple effects of that small investment were incredible. I mean, friendships that continue to this day, but also people feeling empowered and recognizing that the difference that they could make in their community actually mattered. And so we see a lot of these people who've gone on to do other things, building on the ideas that they started with that initial project. When you empower people and give them a little support to say, hey, what you're doing matters, and you can connect people, it's really incredible what they do. One of the recommendations I would have if I was in front of the president or the current Surgeon General is that we need to be investing in local community organizations and individuals who have the ideas, they have the on-the-ground understanding, and with a little bit of support, they can make beautiful things happen. If we have a groundswell of people at the local level improving social health in our neighborhoods all across the country, that is going to add up to so much important change.
You know Robert Putnam's work, Bowling Alone, and recently his work was featured in a documentary, which is To Join or Die, right? By mm-hmm. Pete Davis, who is actually a neighbor of ours in the DC area. And what I found so captivating about the way Pete framed it was that the drop-off in participation in civic things is destroying our capability to have democracy, to have conversation, to actually build the future of our country from an even political and a participatory standpoint. And so that made me really think about that intersection between your work and the Robert Putnam and Pete Davis work around not just the social health from the standpoint of our individual happiness, but really our societal happiness and our ability to self-govern. And I don't know, have you thought about that at all, about the connection between those different things?
There were quite a few studies that came out kind of during and after COVID showing that neighborhoods and communities here in the US, but also in countries around the world that had those stronger social and community ties to begin with, had fewer cases of COVID-19 and fewer deaths from COVID-19. So it also matters from the standpoint of community resilience and emergency preparedness. Like, it's vital for us to know each other and have a support structure in place at the community level for emergencies that we might face. We've also seen examples of this from, you know, the tsunami in Japan and heat wave in Chicago and so on. There are many examples of this where when we have those connections in place beforehand, when we're already socially healthy, that better prepares us to get through difficult times.
We talked a little bit about the policy domain and what the Attorney General could do. And I'm curious if you were pitching to a VC and thinking about what business opportunities there might be in this space. And we'll maybe taking aside the technology ones for now, because we'll circle back to that in a minute. But what would be some businesses that want to come into being in the social health space?
You know, I do have some ideas. I think actually more what I would be interested in is I would love to set up a VC fund for innovation in this space, period, and vet these companies because there are so many amazing founders who are already thinking about this and better, you know, entrepreneurs than I would be. But I would love to help support that innovation. I would love to do that. If anyone listening would like to help me and collaborate on that, let me know.
Okay, you heard it here.
There's, I can't remember where I first read this. Maybe you know this, but there's this expression, health by stealth. And so I love thinking about like, what are the opportunities to improve people's social health without them necessarily realizing, you know, like have that be disguised. So one example that comes to mind, which isn't a startup, but it's an initiative in the Netherlands where they have these chat checkouts. So when you go to the grocery store, you can go through the regular checkout lane and just pay and leave, or you can go through a chat checkout lane, which you know is going to take longer, but it means that you get to talk to the cashier and to each other people in the line, and it's kind of conversational and it's literally meant for connection. So that's this opportunity where, you know, they're not billing it as a public health intervention. And yet I would argue that it actually is one.
And that, I like that too, because I was thinking a little bit about loving these examples from your talk and your talks and your book that are really playful, that are either playful or have a lot of agency, because then it doesn't feel quite so like another burden, or where it's a very small micro thing you might do that might open you up to other things. So I love that flip of it where it can have a little more playfulness, a little more lightness. So it's not like one more thing that you put on your tracker, you know, that you're already behind on and you feel bad about it.
One of the most common questions I get from people is, I'm just too busy, right? And to your point, like, this is just another thing to add to my to-do list. Like, really? And I relate to that. I'm one of those busy people. And so I think it's important to empower us with ways that we can weave connection into the reality of our day-to-day. At the same time, I hate that we're living lives where we're too busy to sit down and have dinner with our family. That's one statistic that still haunts me from researching for my book, where the amount of people who say they had family dinners on a regular basis growing up has steadily decreased from generation to generation. So it's like, we're too busy to have dinner with each other, right? We're too busy to call our grandparents. This is where it gets back to, yes, there's what we can do as individuals, but we also need to shift our whole culture to where we're not so busy, right? To where things are in service of being able to have the time to connect and nurture physical, mental, and social health, because that's the point of living. If we don't have time to spend time with our loved ones, what are we doing?
My dad grew up in a very small town of a couple thousand people in Illinois. His family ran the general store. They were all farming. All of their lives were intertwined, and at school and clubs and the bank, whatever. It just came naturally, right? It was a direct result of the structure of daily living that didn't require an extra effort. It just is the way things were. And it makes me wonder, what are the more fundamental shifts that could free that space Or will we see more people making bigger life choices that move in that direction? I'm thinking about my son does not have a smartphone. And his only electronic device, he's living with us right now, he keeps in the kitchen, so he doesn't have access to it, except when he intentionally comes and uses it. And a lot of his gatherings with friends are singing and telling stories and things. And I think right now those kinds of behaviors seem a little impossible for most of us, but it just makes me wonder, as more people make such intentional choices that do create more systemic structures in their own lives, if those possibilities will seem more accessible to the rest of us.
I think that speaks to kind of a backlash to the way that we're living. And I think, you know, Jonathan Haidt's work on the anxious generation and trying to drive for no smartphones in schools and things like that, that's part of this, right? There is this slow reckoning that we're not doing something right here and we need to make some changes. It's tricky. Like, I was just listening to a talk by this researcher who's looked at loneliness around the world and found that oftentimes people in collectivistic cultures are lonelier.
Interesting.
So in these countries, you know, it's expected that you're going to be embedded in the family and socializing all the time. And so if you deviate from that in any way because, you know, you value solitude or because there's a relationship that's unhealthy and so you choose to not maintain it or things like that, that norm deviation is what puts you at risk for the loneliness because that's not considered socially acceptable. So anyway, this is one example and, you know, it's a very big nuanced topic, but I think what that points to is we need to figure out what's the direction we're going, right? Like your son choosing not to use smartphones and having those collective shared experiences with other people. What does the future of connection look like for all of us? And how do we truly create a socially healthy society, whether we're here in the US or another country where the norms are just different?
So interesting. I've occasionally done research on intentional communities, like co-living, thinking that would be fun. And then I actually sit down and imagine it for myself. And I say, no, I don't think so. Like, I would love a version of it, but it would have very specific guidelines.
Yes, I know. I've thought about this too, because I go back and forth. I think about, you know, being in college with roommates or, you know, living in a dorm, it was so fun. It really, yeah. It felt good, but also,
at moments.
Yeah,
there were moments. Other moments. Let's talk about technology. I want to talk a little bit about social media, which you've described as the junk food of connection, and also talk about AI. You do a really beautiful job in your writing and talking about including these as part of the ecosystem of connection, while also pointing out the dangers and the traps we fall into when we think about technology and even remote connection versus in person. So I'd love to have you parse this a little bit for us. How should we be thinking about social media and technology? What are ways that we can tap the beautiful extensibility that they provide for us while, you know, really paying attention to what's going to be healthy for ourselves?
I think the word you used was ecosystem, and that's a good way of thinking about it. Think of your social portfolio, your social ecosystem. The reality is there are going to be all different ways that we interact with other people. And some of those are going to be over Zoom or over text or over FaceTime. That is just the reality of the world we're living in. However, studies are showing that in-person interaction has something unique about it. And, you know, we can think about why that is. Is it the oxytocin release? Is it the dopamine? Is it being able to see the verbal cues, you know, and really experience them? Is it being able to hug someone? But it's clear that there's kind of this hierarchy where in-person is ideal, and then it goes down from there. But it's about having an ecosystem, right? If all your interaction is in person, that's not realistic. If all your interaction is online, that is not going to feel fulfilling either. So it's about kind of monitoring what is that ratio of ways that you're connecting with people. And then on the AI point, you know, it's interesting. I spent some time kind of exploring this for my book, and it's come up a lot in my work since then because, you know, now I just saw a paper come out from Harvard Business Review showing that the number one way that people are using AI in this year is for companionship and friendship. Number one. So it's very relevant. We really need to be thinking about this. And my first reaction when I started exploring this a few years ago was just horror. Like, why are there hundreds of millions of people around the world turning to AI for their emotional needs, right? To socialize, to share their troubles with, for love. People use AI as friends, as boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives. This is a huge way that these tools are being used. But my thinking evolved into one that's more of compassion. A lot of people are turning to these tools because they're not having the success that they want connecting with other people in person and having those human relationships. And so there again, we're getting something wrong collectively if that's the case. But I don't think it's all bad. I also don't think the answer is nobody should have an AI bot who they interact with for humor or for comfort when they need it or for advice or things like that. I think that the reality is what we see in the data is it's socially healthy to have diverse people who you interact with, right? You don't just only talk to your romantic partner and no one else. You also have friends, you have coworkers, you have neighbors, you have groups that you're part of. There's variety to who you interact with. And if AI is one of the kind of quote unquote people in your overall social ecosystem who you're drawing support from in some way, I actually think that could be okay. And I think some of the early data on this is suggesting that it can be. Where I get concerned is when AI is a substitute for human connection rather than a supplement to human connection. It can be additive, but if it's the only way that we're fulfilling our social and emotional needs, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. And it's also making me wonder, have our social skills declined? And if you think about we're spending more time online, we're not having family dinner, schools, I think there's probably less time playing. Certainly you don't have the phenomenon as much now of the kids are out in the neighborhood. Their activities are planned for them. And so I just wonder if some of these trends are reflecting more friction around interacting because we haven't navigated conflict as much. Maybe we haven't had as many friendships where we had to figure it out on our own. I don't know what all the dimensions are, but it would make sense to me that those things would go together.
Yeah, I can't say I've seen data specifically on whether social skills are declining, but I definitely know that, you know, the pandemic was a hit for a lot of people in developing social skills, right? Because they were not interacting in person. You use that word friction, though, and I think it's interesting. In a lot of ways, we've designed away friction that is actually useful for social health, right? Now you can order groceries and never interact with the person who drops them off rather than going to the grocery store and having a chat checkout lane where you can get some interaction, right? It's so easy to actually not see other humans and not have to interact. And so in some ways, and this is something that I know Thomas talks about, who's a fellow Impact Fellow, and Steve Downs, this idea of we actually need to design for more friction in order to connect. Like, friction isn't necessarily bad. So I'm taking your use of friction and running with it in a different direction. But I think it's interesting to think about how are we designing our products and our environments so that there's a good amount of friction, right? Like the right amount to where we have convenience, but also we have connection.
I've been so delighted to partner with you and other Impact Fellows this year. It's an amazing program we have at the School of Public Health to bring in field leaders like Casley. And one of the things you've been thinking about and working on is this idea of a movement for social health and really taking lessons from the changes that have come about over the last generations around thinking about mental health. What would a movement around social health look like? And what are the takeaways from those prior historical lessons that we might apply in this case?
Yeah. Well, I think the movement is underway. It's already happening. There are so many incredible people in different sectors who are talking about and working on social health. It's really, really exciting to be part of that momentum. To your point, what I've been thinking about is, you know, we've seen just in my lifetime, the rise of mental health to where emotions and our thoughts and kind of our internal experiences are being elevated, right? To now where it's very common to talk about mental health. Every politician talks about it. Celebrities are talking about their mental health. There are so many campaigns around this, workplace programs for mental health. It is just a pervasive part of the mainstream now. That wasn't true 20 years ago, right? It was still taboo and kind of niche and maybe misunderstood. So what I'm still exploring is kind of what are those levers that made that happen and that really made mental health a part of our everyday conversation, right? A part of our understanding of what it means to be healthy and to live well. Because we need the same with social health. And right now, you know, connection is often either talked about as mental health, right? As part of mental health, even though it influences so much more, or it's kind of disregarded as something that's very touchy-feely. And so what I'm excited about is how do we continue to give momentum to the rise of people recognizing the importance of connection, using the language of social health, and really establishing that. I think if we in 10 years are where mental health is today, we're going to be in a really good spot. And I believe that that's underway. Social health is becoming more and more pervasive, and that's only going to keep accelerating.
For some people, writing a book and getting it out is the ending point. And what's so exciting about you is it's just the beginning of what I know will be lots of work in this area. Probably, I'm hoping, more books and more action to get this to really happen. So thank you so much for joining. It's been really fun.
Thank you so much, Claudia. It's always a pleasure. I'm honored. So thank you.
I came away from this conversation really committed to strengthening my own social connections. But it's also clear that the basic structures of my, and of our, daily living are not set up for connection. So I am left asking, what are the systems changes we can make in the environments we work, play, and live in every day that will move the dial on human connection and belonging? Because left unchecked, our current loneliness epidemic will only get worse. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Kasley Killam and her book. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.